NPR is doing its annual survey to better understand how listeners like you spend time with podcasts. So please help us out by completing a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcastsurvey. It's all one word. We would really appreciate your help to support NPR podcasts. Again, that is npr.org/podcastsurvey. All one word. Thanks.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now. On Capitol Hill, U.S. senators are inching closer to something that has eluded them for years, a deal on gun control legislation. Even conservative Republicans like Senator John Cornyn of Texas are considering support for red flag laws and changes to the background check system. But if they pass, the new regulations would still fall far short of what gun safety activists and most Democrats want. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson joins us now. Mara, welcome.
Happy to be here.
Both sides do seem more confident than usual that they can get something done here. Let's listen to Democratic Senator Chris Murphy, who spoke recently to CNN.
I've never been part of negotiations as serious as these. There are more Republicans at the table talking about changing our gun laws and investing in mental health than at any time since Sandy Hook. Now, I've also been part of many failed negotiations in the past, so I am sober-minded about our chances.
So is this time really different, Mara?
Well, it seems different, but to say it's different would be a triumph of hope over experience because, as Senator Murphy just pointed out, most of these negotiations failed. After Sandy Hook, the negotiations to have universal background checks failed. But what they're doing this time is they're going to the lowest common denominator, what Republicans will accept, because it takes 60 votes, 10 Republicans, to pass anything in the Senate. And because these gun safety measures are so minor and incremental, that's why they seem to have a better chance of getting passed. But we're going to have to wait and see.
One of the reasons they are minor is that Senator Cornyn of Texas has had a lot of sway. He's the most conservative negotiator on the team, so they kind of have to bring him along. What kind of influence is he having?
Well, he's having a lot of influence because he's the key to getting 10 Republican senators. Excuse me. John Cornyn is somebody who wants to be the majority leader or the Republican leader at some point when Mitch McConnell retires or steps down. That might never happen. But he wants to show that he can bring his caucus along, show Republicans that there are things that they can vote for in terms of gun safety that won't hurt them with their base. So, you know, he's kind of this is a tryout for a leadership position, and he is really key here.
What kind of evidence is there that the measures they are willing to discuss will help prevent a mass shooting?
Well, red flag laws could prevent mass shootings. Making it harder for 18-year-olds to get an assault weapon. They're not talking about a national law raising the age to buy an assault weapon from 18 to 21. They're just talking about making the background check program harder or more involved for people who are 18 and 19 years old. Maybe that would stop a mass shooting, because in several of these recent mass shootings, an 18-year-old has been able to walk into a gun store, buy a gun that day, no problem, no extensive background check. Of course, a lot of these people don't have criminal records. They're 18 years old, and then go and commit a massacre. So some of these measures might prevent some mass shootings.
President Biden has been calling on lawmakers to go much further than it seems like there is support for, including an outright ban on assault weapons. I mean, what kind of role is the president playing in all of this, if any?
The president is using his bully pulpit, as you said. He met with Chris Murphy today. Biden has been long associated with gun control. He passed the ban on assault weapons in the Senate when he was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. That assault weapons ban lasted for 10 years, from 1994 to 2004. Mass shootings went down during the ban, and they went up after the ban expired. So he's playing a role. He wants something to pass through Congress, but he's also, in his speech the other day, saying very clearly, even if Congress doesn't pass the things that we need, like a ban on assault weapons, like universal background checks, et cetera, that voters should take their outrage over these shootings and apply it at the ballot box. In other words, elect more Democrats who would be willing to pass these more robust gun safety laws. So he's really playing an outside game and a little bit of an inside game. It's really a game that's inside the Senate, and it's all about 10 Republicans. Biden isn't a crucial player in getting this legislation passed. He's just a crucial player in the political debate about gun safety.
And just very briefly, Mara, what's the timeline here? When might we see a vote?
Well, there are people who say senators who have said they expect to have an agreement this week, but Chris Murphy has resisted putting any kind of deadline for a vote.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A lot has happened in the year and a half since the January 6th insurrection. On one hand, hundreds of people have been arrested for their involvement in the attack on the Capitol. At the same time, dozens of candidates across the country have campaigned in support of the big lie that the presidential election was stolen from Donald Trump. Public hearings on the January 6th insurrection begin this Thursday, and at least one historian says a tepid response there might signal a real threat to our democracy. Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, has a warning for us about normalizing the January 6th attack. He joins us now. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Your warning is that a lot of listeners may not see January 6th as a normal event. Tell us what you're concerned about.
Well, it's not just January 6th, the actual day of an insurrection. It was the entire campaign from election night forward to overturn the election. And we learn more and more about how deep that effort was. And if that becomes a normal part of the democratic process, then the democratic process won't work. At some level, losers have to accept the outcome. And if we move beyond that, and this is seen as just another part of our polarized era, I think the system has a big problem.
Well, Democrats are also obviously hoping that these public hearings have a powerful impact. They hope to show that criminal activity led to the storming of the U.S. Capitol. What is at the stake? What is at stake here, though, if there isn't a powerful impact on the public, if people don't pay attention?
Well, it's a good question. Hearings are important inherently just to produce as much information as we can have about something like this. But if the hearings produce the kind of bombshell revelations that some congresspeople have promised, and there is no real change in either public sentiment or the political response to everything that happened, then at some level, it might be even worse. It might be legitimizing what happened as something that's permissible as opposed to something that should be inexcusable in our political process.
It sounds like in terms of normalization, you're going to be watching the reaction to the hearings. But what are you watching for during the hearings themselves?
Well, I think we know a lot about what happened, and that makes these hearings a little unusual. A lot of what happened January 6th and otherwise was done in broad daylight. So I think what we're really looking to understand is intentionality. How much was this really orchestrated? How many people were involved in setting up the election challenge and actually being part of setting up January 6th? And it seems that's where most of the information is coming from. And how high up did that go? But again, a lot of this was done in broad daylight. So we're filling in information as opposed to telling a big story, which was what happened in 1973 with the Watergate hearings.
There must be a reason why you're concerned that the reaction to these hearings will be ho-hum. What are you seeing that's making you worried that that might happen?
Well, first of all, many people just won't be watching. And we know that in the modern TV media age, there's so many choices. We know a lot of people don't tune in to high-profile hearings. Second, this has been a story that's gone on for a long time, and it's not as if the public's getting more invested in January 6th. They're moving on to other issues, and in large parts of the Republican Party, they're digging deeper into election denialism, with it even becoming a theme in the 2022 midterm. So all of that points to a trajectory where it's very hard for hearings, no matter how well they're going to be done, to really change the dynamics of the country.
So you point out that during Watergate, it was actually Republican leaders who urged the Republican, President Nixon, to resign. And now you're telling me that candidates are running on what's known as the big lie, the lie that motivated many people to storm the Capitol. Even some elected officials are supporting it. have we crossed a Rubicon here? Have we already crossed a line?
I think so. I think that was a story of much of the Trump presidency where norms and processes kept getting broken and nothing happened. And the contrast with Watergate, which culminates with a group of high-level Republicans confronting the president, Richard Nixon, in August of 1974 and saying, you have to step down. You're not going to have our vote if impeachment reaches the Senate. Compare that to today, where Republicans have generally obstructed the investigation. Those who've stood against President Trump have been marginalized, and a lot of younger candidates are running on the big lie. It shows just how much our political world has changed and where the GOP has shifted over the decades.
And Julian, we only have about 30 seconds left, but what's the ideal outcome here? Is it for somebody who's in political office or was in political office to be charged?
Well, either charged or pay a political price for having been involved, where people lose seats, lose power as a result of trying to overturn an election. That's the ultimate measure in a democratic process, and that would be what we would be looking for.
Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University. His latest book is The Presidency of Donald J. Trump, A First Historical Assessment. Julian, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Singer-songwriter Amos Lee is on tour throughout the summer. He's supporting his latest album, Dreamland, which takes the listener on a rich and emotional journey, holding up a mirror to Lee's lifelong battle with isolation, fear, and anxiety. Here's the title song, Dreamland.
Dreamland, nothing's ever what it seems. You stumble around and you fall down, you think. It's everybody else's dream. Here in dreamland, everything's a broken line. You think it's you who's falling apart, and everybody else is fine.
Back in February, I spoke with Amos Lee, and he told me about his struggles and why he decided to be so candid with this new project.
I started writing these songs in 2019, and now that I've had time to reflect on it, it was almost like I was in isolation boot camp before the pandemic. Writers are generally isolationists. You kind of have to be one. I mean, Hemingway would probably disagree to an extent, but I would guess that while he was writing, he would be more isolated. And when I'm in my right, like, so my life has two strange chapters that I flip back and forth to. And one is on the road and is extremely social, and one is extremely inward and writing. And so at the end of my last touring cycle, which was now in 2019, I just kind of like really went into a hole and wrote and wrote and made this record. And then guess what, Peter? Back into the hole you go.
We all got it. Oh, you laugh. You sound like a really outgoing guy. You know, you mentioned Ernest Hemingway, who had his own demons to wrestle with. I know you've struggled with anxiety and depression throughout the course of your life. And I want to talk about that if we can, because it seems like this is a theme that runs deeply through your entire album. Do you remember when you first started feeling that way?
I was a kid. I mean, I don't know how old I was, maybe 7. I was laying in bed and I was thinking, what is God? And if God is God, what made God? And if that made God, what made it? And I went into this really like kind of strange tripping out circle of thought where I was like, well, what is the beginning and what is the end? And I had this panic attack and I got out of bed and I ran around the house. No one heard me because I did it silently, because I like to suffer in silence.
But this was actual panic. I mean, this wasn't just like a kid asking questions.
No, it was, I was like, oh God, this is not good. Because I couldn't, you know, that's the existential dread. I just had it earlier than other people. The first time I had a major anxiety episode was when I was 10. I kind of developed agoraphobia, which is really debilitating and intense.
You couldn't go out?
I couldn't leave the house. I walked out and I just felt complete terror.
Wow. Could your family help you? I mean, did they understand what was going on?
No. This is like 1987 or 1988. And like, we weren't having those conversations. You know, I grew up, there was a mental health facility or, you know, a quote unquote institution near where a lot of my family lived, and they closed it down. And I remember like people used to make us scared because they'd be like, yo, everybody's getting out of Byberry. You know, you better be careful when you go outside. And so like, those are kind of the myths that we were running into then, that like any form of mental illness meant you were dangerous. It's much better now that we're having conversations about it. We're having athletes talk about it. We're having artists talk about it. Mm. You know, we can have more meaningful conversations about our struggles.
And that's part of what your album is doing. This song is called Into the Clearing.
I wanna burn up.
You know, I was surprised to hear you say that for most of your life, when you walked into a room, you didn't feel like you belonged. And I wonder, first of all, if you still feel that way, and also if you do think it helps people who aren't famous musicians hear someone like you say that.
It's a complicated answer, obviously. It depends on the social situation. I don't think it has anything with being a famous musician or not, which, by the way, I don't consider myself.
Okay, you know, you're pretty famous. People know who you are.
I consider myself lucky to have an outlet that I can connect to other people through, because music has been the biggest part of me being able to feel like I belong in a room and be able to connect. It's been the bridge of all bridges for me. And I was reading a book during making this record called Lost Connections by Johann Hari. He talks a lot about communal connections and reaching out to other people when you're feeling down. And that's a huge part of this. Like, there are lots of days where, like over the pandemic, I did a lot of over the pandemic as if it was like summer vacation. Over the last 2 years, I've done a lot of live shows over the internet. And there were days when I definitely didn't want to do it. But I willed myself to kind of get into the headspace because I knew it would hopefully at least help someone else. There's a song on the album called See the Light. That's kind of like the lesson that I've been taught most of my life by my family, which is like, if you're feeling bad, try to do something good for someone else, like help them or help yourself to see the light through them.
Even when I lose a win, even when I fail to place, when I fall off the map and disappear without a trace, even when I can't breathe in and I'm falling out of line, and everybody around me says that everything gonna be alright. See the light, see the light, see the light, see the light.
You know, speaking of community and people helping each other out, I want to ask you about someone who I know is an inspiration for you, the great songwriter John Prine, who died of COVID. You know, I spoke recently with Sturgill Simpson, who told me what a blow that was for him personally. What did John Prine mean to you?
John Prine is the reason why I'm doing what I'm doing. I mean, I can pretty much say that he was sort of the genesis of this. Like, I didn't even know what an acoustic guitar was before I was 18. I didn't grow up listening to folk music. I grew up listening to hip hop and R&B. And I went to college and I got a guitar. And I went to see Prine play at the Township Auditorium in Columbia, South Carolina. And I was like, that's it. Like, that's the stuff. This is the perspective that I've been missing in my life. Like, you know, think about a song like Hello in there.
You know that old trees just grow stronger. And old rivers grow wilder every day. Old people just grow lonesome, waiting for someone to say hello in there.
That's exactly what he was talking about.
Isolation. Yeah. Loneliness.
And reaching out and saying hello in there and saying like, hey, you know, you're not alone. Not that that makes any of the dread go away forever, but it's a temporary pause, like a Hershey kiss, you know? It's like, here we are.
Getting back to your album, because we've been talking about some pretty heavy stuff. You know, I hear hopefulness in your music as well, and we can hear it on this one. This is called Worry No More.
Worry no more.
Honestly, what has helped you get through some of your most difficult times?
Music, obviously, is the biggest one. Friends, the people that love me. There is so much beauty that's constantly around, and we get bogged down because there's an avalanche of fear. There's an avalanche of anxiety that is there for us whenever we're climbing. You know, I was watching a bunch of documentaries about climbers and Everest, and there is a kind of a beautiful analogy thinking about like an avalanche occurring not on top of you, but on the side that you just like, all right, I'm still going to climb, you know, because I am going to get to that peak. I'm going to see the summit. If I turn back now, I'm never going to see it. So there's sort of like this hopefulness that there's always more beauty ahead. And that's what music gives to me. There's always this hope that there's more beauty ahead.
Amos Lee, the new album is called Dreamland. It is really beautiful. Thanks for making it, and thanks for speaking with us about it.
My pleasure, man.
See you in the doorway. There's tears on your face.
Our interview first aired in February. Amos Lee is out on tour for dates and cities. Go to hereandnow.org.
Don't need no one to fix you. Cause babe, you ain't broken. There's hope in your eyes. The new sun will rise. You shall be woken. I wanna hold you. I just wanna.
We are nearly a week into the Atlantic hurricane season, and there's already been a major storm. In fact, even before Tropical Storm Alex officially formed over the weekend, it dumped more than a foot of rain on South Florida. And forecasters are predicting a very active hurricane season this year. Let's bring in Jeff Huffman. He is digital meteorologist at Barron Weather. Jeff, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Yeah, sure thing. So the federal government, NOAA, is forecasting 14 to 21 named storms, and up to 10 of those could become hurricanes. What do you think the summer is going to be like for people who live along the Atlantic and Gulf coasts?
Well, yeah, the average numbers of all of our reputable forecast agencies are, again, above normal. May not be quite as active as some recent seasons. Remember, 2020 was the busiest on record, and then that was followed last year by the third busiest. Another active year is expected. We did not have a preseason storm this year. Alex formed just after the season began, and that reversed a trend of 7 years in a row with a storm forming before June 1st. But all signs do point to another busy season in the Atlantic Basin.
And they are just forecasts, but what kind of conditions are you looking for as you watch these weather patterns form over the Atlantic?
Well, we have what's an ongoing La Nina, which is a cooling of the equatorial Pacific waters. That should not deter storm development like an El Nino can. That is likely to continue through at least the early fall. Also, I looked at sea surface temperatures this morning. They are still trending above normal in most of the Atlantic Basin, especially of concern are the areas in farther northern latitudes, such as areas closer to our coastlines. And we also have weaker low-level winds and a stronger African monsoon projected. So all of these signs are pointing to an increase in confidence that it will be a busy year.
You had mentioned some of the recent past hurricane seasons that were above average, but actually, if this one turns out the way you think it would be the seventh year in a row of above average storm activity. What can you say about that? I mean, at this point, are we still wondering whether this is climate change?
Well, the doubt on that is, of course, decreasing. We're kind of in some uncharted waters right now, pardon the pun, because for many years there's been this theory that water temperatures and ocean currents ebb and flow over the course of several decades, which leads to longer periods of below or, as we're in now, above normal activity. But there's recent research that's disputed this a bit. It's also complicated by evolutions on our detection techniques. But overall, at the end of the day, we do see an increase in activity, and we know storms are getting stronger. But for most of us, I keep reminding everyone, it's not about the total number of storms out there. We all have to continue to prepare for that one that could impact us each year.
And just briefly, I mean, to that point, do you see people kind of getting used to this above average hurricane season, or are they more prepared than in past years because they know it may be coming?
Well, there's a lot of things changing. We have an increase in population growth along our most vulnerable coastlines. We're seeing storms rapidly intensify closer to the coast. They're reaching their maximum intensity at farther north latitudes. So I believe that there has been appropriate awareness and preparation in many cases. In fact, we've had several major hurricane landfalls with some unusually low numbers in terms of fatalities. But of course, the property damage and the cost of these storms continues to increase. And I still remind everyone, you know, preparing a little bit at a time is a lot better than, you know, thinking about that monumental task of trying to prepare for a storm. So you can start now. The most active period of hurricane season is not until August and September.
And we hope the forecasts are wrong. Jeff Huffman at Barron Weather. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
The lines have been drawn. All but one of the 44 states with more than one congressional district have now finished redrawing their maps for the upcoming midterm election. Only Louisiana's map remains tied up in court. And after a year of partisan battles and lawsuits, the once-a-decade redistricting cycle has ended with a map that's less competitive. David Daly has been following this. He's a senior fellow for Fair Vote and the author of two books on gerrymandering, most recently Unrigged: How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. Hi, David.
Thanks for having me on, Celeste.
So yet again, we have a map in which there are fewer swing districts now than before, fewer districts in which the vote could go either to Republicans or Democrats. Why is that?
Because what we've seen this cycle is that both parties have aggressively worked to gerrymander as many seats as they can in the states that they control. Democratic strategists believe that much of the Republican advantage over the last decade has been erased. Republicans, meanwhile, are also claiming victory, believing that they've strengthened their incumbents and gained seats in rapidly diversifying states like Texas and Florida, Georgia and Arizona. But if the national map resembles something close to a stalemate, it was produced by these gerrymanders on steroids in states that Republicans control, the states that Democrats control, that will have the effect of underrepresenting voters of color, dooming most Democratic voters in red states and Republican voters in blue states. And I think the losers here are going to be the voters who longed for fair maps, for competitive districts, meaningful elections, and who hope that this redistricting cycle might deliver that.
So what is the harm to democracy here? I mean, obviously, this is makes things different for the parties themselves, but what about democracy as a whole?
Well, the first is that when you have all of these uncompetitive districts, it makes the most important election the party primary. And party primaries tend to be low turnout, summer elections, and they tend to be dominated by the base. So you end up with more extreme candidates, and even if an incumbent is not primaried, they fear a primary challenge more than they fear a general election challenge. And then what happens is once those candidates are in office, they no longer really worry about voters. So you can see this now in our politics, you know, both nationally as well as in state legislatures around the country. Whether the issue is gun reform or reproductive rights or voting rights, there are huge majorities on the side of action on these issues. And yet our politics too often is going in the other direction than what the public would like to see. And so much of that is based on gerrymandering.
This year's redistricting cycle, as you mentioned, continued what is a long-term trend of underrepresenting voters of color. And a federal judge struck down Louisiana's new congressional map for violating the Voting Rights Act. So overall, how do these new maps look for voters of color?
What we've seen in Texas, for example, a state which received two additional seats in Congress because of population gains, 95% of which were driven by voters of color. And yet Latino voters and Black voters actually lose political power in the state of Texas based on these maps. In the state of Florida, you're going to see two majority Black seats disappear as a result of the maps that Ron DeSantis and the Republican legislature there have enacted. While the nation continues to become more multiracial, we are struggling to actually become a multiracial democracy. And so much of that as well is because of redistricting and gerrymandering. It's quite intentional.
Some states did pass redistricting reforms. Some states set up independent commissions to make this process nonpartisan. Did any of that move the needle?
Those reforms, I think, are a mixed bag this cycle. You had state courts in New York and Virginia that had to step in and effectively fix the process there after partisans tried to push citizen-supported reforms off the rails. I would say Ohio right now is the state that has the biggest concern. The Republicans who control the state commission have refused under court order now several times to draw fair and constitutional maps. And there is going to be an election this fall in the state of Ohio on a map that the state Supreme Court has said again and again is unconstitutional. Lawmakers there effectively ignored citizens. They have steamrolled over the Supreme Court, and it is truly a lawless process.
David Daly, a senior fellow for Fair Vote. David, thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Let's go to Missouri now, where biologists are keeping an eye on the descendants of a giant prehistoric fish. They're called lake sturgeon, and they've been gliding through the depths of some North American rivers since the time of the dinosaurs. The lake sturgeon has made it this far only to become endangered. And as St. Louis Public Radio's Shayla Farzan reports, scientists really want to save these ancient creatures.
The lake sturgeon is a strange-looking fish with a curved snout, tail like a shark, and long whiskers near its mouth. Adults can be huge, growing longer than a king-size bed and weighing hundreds of pounds.
They're just very strong, powerful fish, so they start thrashing around. It's hard to hold on to them.
Sarah Pieper is a state fisheries biologist in Missouri. In April, as she was getting ready for church, she got an urgent phone call from a colleague. Lake sturgeon were spawning along the banks of the Mississippi River near St. Louis, where we're now standing. Pieper has been studying lake sturgeon for years, but she had never seen the fish reproduce in the wild. On that day, she and other scientists watched as the fish congregated in the shallows, thrashing their tails and releasing peppercorn-sized eggs.
And it was like we had a little sturgeon spawning party on the shoreline. We were all just so excited.
Lake sturgeon were once found in waterways ranging from Minnesota to Tennessee, but populations have plummeted in the past century, and the species is now listed as endangered in 9 states. Lisa Izzo is a fisheries researcher at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. She says because sturgeon take years to mature, overfishing has decimated some populations. But she adds that river dams are also to blame.
The dams in a lot of these systems cut off their access to that really high-quality spawning habitat, so they weren't able to reproduce as successfully.
Izzo and others say protecting spawning sites is critical for sturgeon conservation. But where are these fish going to spawn? That question has long stumped scientists because lake sturgeon can be hard to find.
It's not like you can just put a net out there and catch 20 or 30 fish.
Researchers in Missouri are using technology to track sturgeon during spawning season. This spring, they captured adults and implanted radio transmitters under the silvery skin of their bellies. On an April morning, Pieper and two other scientists climb into a boat in the Mississippi River.
Everybody aboard. Everybody life vest.
Yeah, might want that.
They submerge a microphone in the water, listening for tagged fish. A radio receiver pings when a sturgeon is nearby.
Okay, and so we just heard a fish, and it was a strong enough signal to give us a number.
Each tag has its own ID. This fish, number 22462, was tagged 3 years ago in Iowa. Army Corps biologist Ryan Swearingen says by tracking the movements of individual fish, scientists hope to pinpoint habitats to protect.
We can help keep this area as hospitable as we can during that prime spawning period.
The project is just one piece of a larger effort to bring lake sturgeon back from the edge of extinction. So far, Pieper says, sturgeon have survived cataclysmic events over 150 million years.
You know, we had the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs. We had continents crashing into each other and pulling apart. And these fish survived all of that.
But, she says, lake sturgeon may not survive us unless we take action now to protect them. For NPR News, I'm Shayla Farzon in St. Louis.
June is a month for celebrating. You may have a summer wedding on your calendar, maybe a graduation, Father's Day, Juneteenth. And Celeste, I think that means there is ample opportunity to impress our friends and families with our cooking skills.
Or do the opposite, right? I'm throwing a baby shower for a friend this week. And, you know, I have to offer something that goes a little beyond sandwiches and quiche, right? I need to make an impression.
You do, and you should. And we know someone who can help. Here and now, resident chef Kathy Gunst is here. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, both of you.
So, Kathy, the recipes that you bring to us usually are pretty quick and easy to make. This time, not so much. Why are you complicating things?
Well, I'm not complicating things. I'm elongating them, let's say. Okay. I do. I tend to focus on really quick, really simple seasonal recipes because that's what everybody wants when they're driving home on a Tuesday night and maybe they hear me talk about something and it's super simple. These are, listen, don't get me wrong. I'm not telling you to take the day off from work and I'm not saying that these are wildly difficult recipes, but they take a bit longer and they are geared towards that special celebration that's coming up this month, this summer. So with that in mind, that's kind of the focus. But the payoff, totally worth it.
Well, you are asking us to make a spinach souffle, which I think is definitely going to take some extra work. Soufflés scare people, frankly. How do you make it doable?
They do scare people because I think everyone's kind of imagining Julia Child or a French chef in front of them with a special souffle dish and what they used to call a collar, which was creating this paper crown for the souffle dish. And it was like, help, I can't do this. No, these are souffles that are baked in little individual ramekins or even a regular old oven-proof skillet. All you do is saute some beautiful fresh spinach, which is in season right now, and then you make a white sauce, which is sounds fancy again. You mix melted butter and flour, cook it for a few minutes, add some milk, a little grated Parmesan, done. Put your spinach mixture in. Crack some egg yolks in there, but you're going to keep the egg whites separate. That whole mixture comes together, and then this is what creates a souffle. You whip the egg whites until what's called stiff peaks, and that means when you lift the beaters out of the egg whites, they hold little mountain shapes. They're not watery and wet. They're beautifully stiff, and then that's folded into the spinach mixture, put right into your skillet, and as Julia would say, voila.
Though if you're going to whip 8 egg whites to stiff peaks, that means you've separated out the yolk, right? And
correct.
You know, not everybody's great at that. How do you separate your eggs?
Okay, good. Good question. Two bowls. They're ready. They're empty. You're going to crack the egg, and you're going to let the white ooze out. But what you're going to do is keep the yolk in one half of the shell, and you're going to very gently, not toss is not the right word, you're going to transfer it from one half to the other while you let the white drip out. If some yolk gets into the white, take an empty eggshell half and scoop it out. It will lift right out. You don't want yolk in your whites because it will be harder for them to whip up.
Hmm. These are complicated dishes, so I'm worried that we're going to run out of time here, but let's get to your vegetable paella.
Okay, this is also a beautiful dish because everything is prepared ahead of time. You make what's called a sofrito, which is cooking down tomatoes, onion, garlic, peppers, and vinegar. You can do it 2 days ahead of time. You roast some cherry tomatoes. You roast a sweet red pepper. You blanch some asparagus. You saute some leeks. And then you have fresh or frozen peas. And when everybody assembles and you're about an hour outside of dinner, you put this all together in a skillet. And the beauty of it is that you can cook it on the grill outdoors. This is a dish that needs you to prep the ingredients. So if you prep them on Friday and your party's Saturday, you are going to be cool, calm, and confident.
Okay, so we have just about a minute here to talk about a dessert that usually sends people running, and that is a cheesecake. Cheesecake can be difficult, and yours has beautiful strawberry swirls. What about this one?
You guys are being negative here.
No, we're not. We're being realistic. We're journalists.
Okay. This cheesecake, you make a strawberry puree. You simply cook down strawberries. You can add raspberries if you like with sugar and water, and you strain it. Then here's the thing. This cheesecake is so rich and amazing. It's made with ricotta, sour cream, and cream cheese. The mixture is put onto a very simple graham cracker crust. And then you take this puree and you put little dollops of it onto the cheesecake and you swirl it in with a flat kitchen knife so it almost looks like Italian marbled paper. And you get this white, gorgeous cheesecake with these beautiful red swirls. Again, you make it a day ahead of time because it wants to chill overnight. And that will firm it up and you will have a spectacular dessert.
Kathy, with you as our guide, we can do anything.
I like the positivity there.
We're going to have all these recipes at hereandnow.org. Kathy Guns, thanks as always.
Thanks so much.
And just a reminder, NPR is doing its annual survey to better understand how listeners like you spend time with podcasts. So please help us out by completing a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcast survey. It's all one word. We would really appreciate your help to support NPR podcasts. Again, that is npr.org/podcast survey, all one word. Thanks.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.